Hi, welcome to the latest installment of the Lab Medicine podcast. My name is Kelly Swales. I'm the web editor for Lab Medicine. And today we have with us Dr. Charles Beavers. He's going to talk a little bit with us today about blood components for hemostasis.
Thank you, Kelly. Again, I'm Charles Beavers. I'm a CP resident over at the University of Louisville in pathology. Today I'll be reviewing the article, Blood Components for Hemostasis. This was by Dr. Karen Eldon and June Teruya over in Texas Children's Hospital and Baylor Medical College in Houston. What I'd like to talk about today in the abstract was there's pretty much an overview of revised indications and dosing for our regularly transfused blood components. It's pretty important to have targeted therapy these days, and having the right dose at the right time is definitely important. But sometimes it can be kind of difficult because some of the recommendations are either by expert opinion or tradition, and these can be flavored by clinical context as well. Additionally, every blood component that we have has a risk for adverse events, traditionally between transfusion-transmitted infection as well as the non-infectious risk. The big ones include hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV. Some of these things can be selected against by our donor selection process, and we also have a fairly complex system of nucleic acid-based viral testing. So that reduces the infectious risk quite a bit. We have other considerations, including bacterial sepsis as well as trolley transfusion-related acute lung injury, and hemolytic transfusion reactions also account for the majority of transfusion-related deaths that are out there. So I'll go one by one into the components as they talk about it in this paper. The first one being red blood cells. We generally have an indication for them of about 7 to 9 grams per deciliter, and again, that is flavored by clinical context. It depends upon what the patient's need is for oxygen carrying capacity. Most of these products are obtained by whole blood donation. They can be as good for as long as 42 days in storage at 1 to 6 degrees centigrade, depending upon the additive solution that is used. And they can be irradiated, washed, or leukoreduced, depending upon the need. Other indications that we have for this: red blood cells, as mentioned in the paper, have the ability to start some of the coagulation cascade and can be involved in good coagulation, but the main indication here would be for increased oxygenation for our patients. Contraindications that are notable here is iron overload. If someone is receiving too many transfusions, then it is quite possible to overload somebody with iron, such as our sicklers. It's not used for iron folate, iron deficiency, deficiency of folate, or vitamin B12 deficiencies. It makes more sense in those cases to go ahead and give the individual factors themselves. For dosage, we generally accept that the hemoglobin should go up by about 1 gram per deciliter or about 3% per rise in hemoglobin. In the pediatric patients, we generally dose based on weight, and that's 10 to 15 milliliters per kilogram. And the expected increase there is approximately about 2 grams per deciliter of hemoglobin. Complications that we can experience with using red blood cells: acute hemolysis with multi-organ failure is definitely the worst case consequence. It's rare, but it's a very serious complication. And this is typically due to human error, unfortunately. Even though we try as hard as we can, things still get mixed up and labels get crossed one way or another, potentially. The next item up for talk is platelet transfusions. The platelet products in the United States, they're generally all single-donor platelets nowadays. There are very few that are pooled whole-donor platelets anymore, from platelet concentrates, or which was formerly known as the six-pack, although some clinicians will still ask for it, despite that being archaic now. Platelets, they're generally collected by apheresis. They reduce the number of donors that it takes to expose to a patient, which is good. The fewer donors that we expose to people, the less we modulate their immune system, and the less chance that we have of a bad outcome or transfusion reaction to occur. For platelets, ABO compatibility is still a consideration, as it is in red blood cells. It's important here because it could increase refractoriness to the platelets. It could also, depending upon if there are any red blood cells still left in the platelet bag, it could cause interactions immunologically as well. one item that I will mention that's not in the paper is that if there's more than 2 milliliters of red cells within the platelet component, that it must be ABO and Rh typed in addition, although generally platelets do not express the RhD antigen, which is mentioned in the paper. Because the platelets have a shelf life of about 5 days, use of older units entails concern for patient safety and efficacy. Just because there's platelets in the bag doesn't mean that they're necessarily active or efficacious. The other consideration is because of the temperature that we store them at, 20 to 24 degrees centigrade, there is the potential for bacterial growth, causing transfusion-associated sepsis, which causes very poor outcomes in patients. The indications here are for, of course, severe thrombocytopenia. Oftentimes, prophylactic platelet transfusion will occur in non-bleeding patients, and that's generally something we try to avoid, but can't be avoided in some cases where people have hematologic malignancies or in neonates. There is a great concern, even though theoretically be as low as 5,000 platelets per milliliter in order to maintain coagulation. So there are a variety of different transfusion triggers out there for platelets that are listed in Table 2 of this article. For prophylactic, they recommend less than 10,000 in adults, less than 30,000 in neonates, and then depending upon various conditions down below, if there's major surgery, less than 50,000 you would want to transfuse, and I will also add, even though that it's not listed in this table, less than 100,000 for complicated cases like neurosurgical or very invasive surgeries that can be indicated. So for contraindications here, platelets can be contraindicated in certain thrombocytopenic conditions, particularly TTP, thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, or other microangiopathies, and this is because of the potential to fuel the fire to increase the fibrin webs and platelet destruction that occurs whenever you administer more platelets, because that's causing part of this microangiopathy. Dosage here, we generally give it by 3 times 10 to the 11th platelets, and this is equivalent to the old 4 to 6 six-pack platelet units that were derived from whole blood. In an adult, 1 unit of apheresis platelet should give you approximately 30,000 to 60,000 platelets per milliliter, and pediatric dosing is differently. It's based on weight. It's 10 milliliters per kilogram or one whole blood-derived dose per equivalent, 10 kilograms, and the expected increase in platelet count is 50,000 to 100,000 per milliliter. So for monitoring the efficacy of the prophylactic platelet transfusion, it's problematic because of its impact on bleeding. Can't really be assessed since the patient wasn't bleeding before the transfusion, so it's difficult to really know if it's being efficacious or not. So there is some controversy there. One way to evaluate if your platelets are refractory or whether they're working or not is to use a corrected count interval. And this is done in order to evaluate what were your platelets before, what were your platelets after, and then what's left. So you perform that calculation via taking the patient's body surface area in meters squared times the platelet count after the transfusion minus the platelet count previous to the transfusion, and then divide that by the number of platelets that you transfuse, and that should give you your corrected count interval, which allows you to figure out if you're refractory or not. If there's a poor recovery of platelets, it's going to be less than 5,000 will be your CCI. If it's more than that, then that means that you're probably not refractory. And you generally do that about an hour after the platelets have been transfused. Move on to the complications of platelets. We mentioned the problem with storing them at room temperature and bacterial contamination. There also is a significant amount of plasma within platelets, and generally that can cause more issues with transfusion-related acute lung injury or trolley, as well as some allergic reactions because of the proteins and plasma that are also included within the platelets. And now we'll move on to the plasma portion of the article. So plasma is the non-cellular fraction of blood, and in addition to our coagulation cascade factors, it also contains complement, immunoglobulin, as well as albumin. And depending upon the circumstance, FFP can be given for any of those reasons to replace a variety of things that are missing in your patient's plasma. We have a couple different varieties of FFP that are out there. some that are frozen within 8 hours, which is to capture the labial factors 5 and 8. And we have FP24. There is a slight decrease in factor 5 and factor 8 after 24 hours, but is generally considered relatively equivalent to FFP. The other potential things that you could use here are thawed plasma, which has less factor 8 and factor 5, but can still be used for any other purpose that plasma is used for besides replacing either of those factors. One thing that you can make from FFP is cryoprecipitate, reduce plasma, and that is precipitating out the cryoprecipitate and separating those two components for potentially therapeutic apheresis for our TTP patients that are out there. The indications that are given for it, we use it a lot for plasma exchange to replace coagulation factors for which we do not have a recombinant factor for, like factor 8 and factor 9. We would not use FFP for, but in somebody with a deficiency of either fibrinogen or factor 13 or von Willebrand's factor, those are all excellent indications for using FFP. Many times people will use FFP to correct INRs greater than 1.5. That's another sticky point that this article mentions and we experience over at our hospital as well. We generally say don't try to correct below anything beyond 1.5 because generally FFP has an INR of 1 to 1.3 itself, so you can only do so much if you're trying to correct down any further from 1.5. It takes more and more units and exposes your patient to more donor exposures and decreases the benefit as well. So in addition, the contraindications here, plasma should not be used as a volume expander. You would want to use crystalloids, as in normal saline, or lactated ringers as a replacement fluid instead of plasma because of the donor exposure as well as the potential infectious risk. For dosing, we generally give it in the range of 2 to 4 units. It would be inappropriate to give 1 unit, and if you go above 4 units, you start getting into giving the patient too much fluid and could result in a transfusion-associated cardiac output type injury, which would be undesirable. Complications that can be experienced here, of course, I mentioned TACO just a moment ago, as well as trolley. Again, that comes up because of the plasma component and all the proteins that are and biological response modifiers that are retained therein. So on table 3 is a listing of the different factors as well as plasma proteins that are retained in FFP, our vitamin K factors as well as fibrinogen, and it gives our half-lives and the levels that it takes to achieve hemostasis, which is useful to refer back to. I'll move on to cryoprecipitate, or cryo as it's known in some circles. We generally thaw it at 1 to 6 degrees centigrade because typically FFP is kept at negative 18 centigrade. The components of cryo include factor 8, von Willebrand's factor, fibrinogen, fibronectin, factor 13, as well as platelet microparticles. And these can be useful because cryoprecipitate is generally in a much smaller volume than FFP, so you can give a more concentrated dose of any one of those factors that your patient is lacking. Another side thing that I will add in, typically clinicians view that as kind of a black box of sorts. Cryoprecipitate is generally not well understood, nor what is included into it, and many people confuse that with FFP, and that is unfortunate, probably not good for our patients because of the way that cryoprecipitate is dosed. We would typically give anywhere from 6 to 10 pooled units together, thus increasing donor exposures, but at a reduced volume, so there's somewhat of a trade-off there. The biggest indication for cryoprecipitate would be fibrinogen replacement in bleeding patients with either hypofibrinogenemia or dysfibrinogenemia if your fibrin is not formed correctly. Contraindications that are here, human-derived viral inactivated or recombinant products are generally recommended to correct most deficiencies that are out there, especially for factor 8, so you would not want to use cryo in that particular circumstance. Should not use for warfarin reversal. That would typically be indication for FFP. And also of disturbing note that was indicated in this article was that it was discovered that an audit revealed approximately 50% of transfusions of cryoprecipitate that were noted, 6 out of 12 in this instance, were inappropriate. And that's unfortunate, but not entirely surprising. And that's concordant with what we've seen at my university as well. For dosing, again, we generally give about 1 unit per 5 to 10 kilograms, and that should raise fibrinogen anywhere from 60 to 100 milligrams per deciliter, assuming that you're covering all of it. ABO compatibility is not an issue here because there's usually a low titer of anti-A or anti-B because all the plasma has been precipitated out. I'll next move on to the pharmaceutical agents. There's a large list of things that we can use now, including vitamin K, DD, AVP, lysine analogs, recombinant factors 7A, factor 8, factor 9, factor 13, subunit A, and an antithrombin, as well as human plasma-derived factors 8, 9, 13, von Willebrand's factor, fibrinogen, antithrombin, and protein C. That's a long laundry list, but it adds to our arsenal of things that we can treat without having to use a human-based product. The first one that I'll mention is DDAVP, and this stimulates, or also known as vasopressin, stimulates the release of preformed factor 8, as well as von Willebrand's factor. It can be used to treat folks that have a mild factor 8 deficiency or von Willebrand's disease. Vitamin K, I'll briefly mention, it's essential as a cofactor for the gamma carboxylation of many of our procoagulant as well as anticoagulant proteins. It's important in anyone who's taking warfarin and is usually the first line agent to be given before we give FFP for reversal of the warfarin effect. In addition, I'll also mention the prothrombin complex concentrates, which are a newer drug that's out there. They are formed of pooled human plasma derivative of concentrates either containing 3 or 4 of the vitamin K-dependent coagulation factors, and that's generally 7, 8, 9, 10, with occasionally 7 will be the one that's pulled out, making it a 3-factor. Only 3-factor concentrate is used for approval in the United States, and that is FIBA, that's factor 8 inhibitor bypassing agent, and that's the only indication that is approved for, although there is a lot of off-label use, as noted in this article, and that's concordant with the experience that I've seen as well. There's not a lot of evidence out there as to whether it's more efficacious than FFP, but it is used commonly, and it's appropriate to probably audit that as well as know that it's happening in your institution. The next item is lysine analog antifibrinolytics, and these include plasminogen and plasmin, which bind fibrin via the lysine binding sites, resulting in a fibrinolysis and a clot digestion. So the two drugs that are available are E-aminocaproic acid, EACA, and tranexamic acid, TXA, which competitively inhibit plasminogen and plasmin, and they stabilize clots, essentially. So antifibrinolytics, they stabilize the clot, but they leave thrombin generation intact, and then widespread thrombosis has been potentially described whenever antifibrinolytics are used in DIC, so that's definitely something you'd want to be careful about if that drug is being used in your hospital. For fibrinogen concentrate, at least here at University of Louisville, we do not have that in stock, but that is a potential option if you have it in your institution instead of giving cryoprecipitate or FFP. Here, because we don't have that concentrate readily available to us, we use FFP. For recombinant factor 7, that is something that we audit every time that it's given from the blood bank. It has the potential to cause massive thrombophilia. It's also known as Novo7 by its trade name. FDA has issued a warning due to the reports of all the thrombotic events that have been associated with the off-label use, much like the PCCs. It'll be used to correct massive bleeding, especially in head trauma and warfarin administration. So there is a lot of risk whenever this drug's used. There's a black box warning out there, but it's important to know when it's being used and how it's being used in conjunction with your blood products. So in summary, I'd like to agree with what the authors have said here. it's definitely an appropriate selection of blood components that are going to prevent unnecessary transfusion, minimize risk at your hospital, improve management of what limited resources we have, and ultimately decrease the cost of the laboratory. There are limited studies that are out there. We have some evidence to go on, but it's not hard and fast in some of these clinical situations that we have to deal with. Sometimes we have to modify our approach, and sometimes we have to make exceptions, but we have to know, in general, what's going to be safe for our patients and what's going to be efficacious.
Thanks, Dr. Beavers. I know that I really found your summary informative, and I think you really summarized the article really well for our listeners. So thanks again for your time today, Dr. Beavers.
Thank you.